Our speaker today is Jonah Wheeler. Jonah serves as a Democratic Party member of the New Hampshire House of Representatives, representing Hillsborough County District 33. Jonah was born in Keene in 2003. I know that's hard to believe, but and moved around New Hampshire a good deal before arriving in Peterborough and graduating from Conval Regional High School in 2021. In June 2020, Jonah was a speaker at a George Floyd rally here in Peterborough. Prior to being elected to political office, he worked on the Bernie Sanders 2020 presidential campaign. Then, at 19 in 2022, when he was sworn in as a member of the New Hampshire House, he was among the youngest state legislators in the United States. He was reelected to a second term in 2024. In Concord, Jonah has served on the Criminal Justice and Public Safety Committee and on the Environment and Agriculture Committee. Thus far, he's succeeded in getting 19 bills passed and signed into law by the governor, including enactment of the law that created a private cause of action for discrimination based on hairstyles that reflect a person's ethnicity, a law that promotes free speech and association at public institutions of higher education, a law increasing the adequacy of grants for pupils receiving special education services. And even after all that, he's still younger than my grandchildren. So, Nick, Liza, Quinn, Silas, this could be you. Please welcome Representative Jonah Wheeler.
Abiel Abbott, in 1828, a clergyman in Connecticut was removed from his position as clergyman because he wanted to host lyceums in Connecticut, which held opinions with unorthodox opinions from the church. And so the churches of New England came together and told him, get out of here. But the people here in Peterborough, with their newly built, beautiful Unitarian church here, invited him up. And from there, in 1828, he started the Lyceum Project. Several years later, he opened up our beautiful Free Public Library, the first public library supported by tax dollars in the world, and started a internationally recognized project, the Lyceum, which continues to this day in offering very variety of opinions of all these different kinds of people, crazy politicians at 22 years old, people who know what they're talking about world affairs, foreign affairs, the issues that are facing us here today. And it's an honor to be invited here and speaking before you. I remember being a young kid growing up in this church. I sat in those pews over there almost every time. And I remember being ushered down to the children's area because that's where they put kids back then. You know, you weren't supposed to hear what was going on. And I remember keep trying to sneak up because I knew they were talking about politics. I just want to hear what's going on up there. But I'm honored to be here and speak in front of you all here today. At that same time in 1828, about 50 years prior to that, the province at the time, as it was called, of New Hampshire was just forming. And New Hampshire formed out of Massachusetts. It started as four little towns here on the seacoast, and then joined Massachusetts with the French and Indian raids affecting the towns, and they needed protection from the Massachusetts legislature. And after some different land deals and things like that, which you can read about in a fantastic book called To This Day by Leon J. Anderson, we ended up in the 1750s, 1776, as the first state with a constitution. Now, those men back then, they fought about a lot of things. They said that you had to have $100 worth of property in order to be in the legislature, $100 worth of property in order to vote, $200 worth of property in order to be in the council, which at that time was the upper body of the legislature. It turned into the Senate. You had to have $1,000 to run for governor. Actually, in fact, the first constitution didn't have a governor. That's how much we loved our assembly. But after so long, people like the Dartmouth College, which had started in the mid-1750s, and their newsletters coming out saying that that structure is undemocratic, it does not represent the republic which it purports to. People shouldn't have a property regulation to get into office. They shouldn't have a property regulation to vote. After so long of people pushing that, pushing, we got there to that point where we had an assembly which represented the people. And that building, which was built in 1816, the beautiful Golden Dome, is the oldest legislature that's still in operation using its original chambers. And that's a beautiful thing. We're here in a beautiful state, the state of New Hampshire, that represents in many ways the republic which we live in here in the United States of America. And in this legislature, they started a whole host of things which continue to this day as the most open and democratic legislature in the 50 states of our country. Things like being able to propose any piece of legislation and then have that legislation get a guaranteed vote on the House floor. Things like making sure that legislation gets a guaranteed public hearing, and all the other important parts to our legislature which mean that it's an open building. My title of this speech here today is Demystifying the Local Government. My 4 years in the legislature have been an honor, and I've very much so loved it, but one thing that chagrins me is how little people know about the legislature. Because it is such an open building, because anybody can come in and have their voice heard, even if they aren't a legislator. Anybody is welcome at the public hearings. Anybody is welcome in the House gallery. Anybody is welcome in the Senate gallery. Anybody is welcome at the Senate hearings. But so often, we don't hear that input. We don't get letters. We don't have people come in. Not because they don't want to or they can't. Some instances, it's because they can't. But in a lot of ways, it's because people don't know how open the legislature actually is. That building feels untouchable. It feels like a castle that shouldn't, whoa, can I go in there? Is that an open building? Yes, you can. And in fact, the legislature is our, I mean, some people don't like this, but it's the only legislature in the country where you can walk in, no metal detector, no security, no wand. You want to come to the legislature, as long as it's open from 9 to 5, you can come in. And that's a very special thing that I think encompasses the spirit that we have here in New Hampshire. The history of the legislature is one of railroads, tax liens, figuring out what the land of the state looks like, figuring out old royal property givens, ordinances. But right now, we're in a world where people don't feel connected with their government. They don't feel like they can have a say. They don't feel like they have a place to redress their grievances. We here in Peterborough have the third highest tax rate in the state, and I hear it all the time, but people don't know how to go to their legislature and advocate for that change. They don't understand why our tax rate is as high as it is. But that's, I think, hopefully, what I can do here today is illustrate a little bit more, remove that level of untouchability to the government, make you realize that it's possible that anyone can serve in the legislature. As Phil mentioned, I grew up here in New Hampshire. I was born in a bathtub in Keene. So it was a home birth. It wasn't as bad as it sounds. But I was born in a bathtub in Keene in 2003, March 1st, 2003. The news at the time had to deal with the war in Iraq, the illegal war in Iraq that we all knew was illegal, started by President Bush. And we knew that he was about to make an announcement on his television, and he did. 15 days later, on March 16th of that year, announced that the United States, essentially unilaterally, would be going in and bombing the cradle of civilization, Mesopotamia, now known as Iraq. They shock and awed that whole place. And I remember a story that my mom tells me of when she brought me home from the birthing center, passing in the circle in Keene. The peace protesters, which were out there every Saturday, it was a Saturday, cold Saturday in the winter, and she passed these peace protesters thinking to herself, what world did I just bring this child into? Where we've been protesting war for so long, And here these people are, the war is starting, and what am I supposed to do about it? What can I do about it as a person who cares, but has to watch these people just stand on the side of the road and hold their flags? I'll never forget that story, and I'll never forget many of the stories that happened in my childhood. We grew up here in New Hampshire. We first lived in Jaffrey, then we moved to Lincoln, and we moved to Nelson, and we moved to up and down the state. We've lived in Seattle for a little bit. I lived in Florida for a little bit, 3 months at a time. We used to move around just about every 3 months at a time. So I've lived in many different places and seen many different things. And growing up, getting that experience and being able to see humanity from all those different places and getting to meet people, you know, never being able to really grow roots, but being able to find roots within yourself, being able to meet all these different amazing people, and then coming back to Peterborough, 3/4 of the way through second grade, and living in this town and a few different places in this town, but this town nonetheless, and getting to know this beautiful, beautiful town that we have here, under the auspice of Monadnock, with the magic that exists here in all of us, getting to meet the artists and the different people who ran government jobs and done big things in their life, who came back to Peterborough because it was that beautiful community where we could all find each other, where there was a smile on the street, where people were happy, and where we had these beautiful buildings of grandeur, where we respected the history that lived around us. So that's the context in which I grew up in. And I grew up, I loved to read, and I loved to read nonfiction books as much as I could. And when you're a lover of history, I can't call myself a student of history, but I'm a lover of history. I love history very deeply, and when you love history as much as I do, you can't stay silent in a moment like this. No matter what side you're on, all of us know that this is a critical moment in the history of the United States of America, this great republic which has inspired people across the world. What they did in the 1700s inspired people in Europe and France and Southeast Asia and across the world. Why do all these different flags internationally have the red, white, and blue stripes? Or red, white, and blue color scheme? Because they were all inspired by the people here in New Hampshire, the people here in Rhode Island and Maine, and the other 13 colonies here in the state. Maine wasn't a 13 colony, but the 13 colonies here in the country, who came together when the world was under the arm of the divine right of kings. It's hard to picture these days unless you think about how under control of corporations we are, but we could not picture a world, they could not, outside of the king was divinely given his position by God. And people for hundreds of years who tried to say otherwise were written off, imprisoned, jailed, killed. And those men who, using their education of the world that existed in the Mediterranean, where the beacon of republic first started under the Roman Empire, they used their history, their knowledge, to create the first government, the first nation, in which you weren't a subject, but you were a citizen. And that new paradigm, which was new at the time, nobody had experienced that before, nobody even really understood what the word citizen was, opened up people's minds to the point where they, for the last 249 years since the founding of this country, have been fighting to put the words that are on paper into practice. That's the spirit of the United States of America, and it's a spirit that continues to this day despite the things that are happening outside of this building right now. Things are tough, and they have been tough before, when the people in the Civil War were fighting for abolition or were fighting for their rights as a homemaker, as someone who knew that slavery was wrong but didn't know how to fight it, they did not necessarily think that they were going to win. But they continued on nonetheless because it was important to do. They didn't give up on the principles of the United States because it was founded with imperfections. They used those imperfections as the driving force to get them to where we are here today. Where we are here today, we're a 19-year-old kid with dreadlocks and a vision, can stand for election in a district with people who are very much so different than he is, and win first place against people who have served in the body for 26 years, 8 years, and get first place. Because people here in this town and in this country understand that we need people of vision, of character, of conscience, up in the legislature, who understand that what they're doing is not serving the interests of corporations or other big multinational interests, but they're serving the interests of the people, the state in which they live. They're doing the best that they can to continue it on for another 250 years. And it has been an honor, given my history and my context, to participate here in the legislature. We grew up very working class. We didn't have anything which told me that I should go to the legislature or that it was going to be easy to do. Everyone, when I was in school, told me that I had such a hard childhood that I would have a hard time getting into the Ivy Leagues until I was in high school, and then people were begging me, go to the Ivy Leagues, go to the Ivy Leagues. But I said, no, because this town and this state need people who know what's happening here in the state to go up to the legislature and advocate for that perspective. We have a legislature that doesn't pay, I'll get into that later, and that results in people who are mainly retired, mainly wealthy, mainly older, being the legislators who can serve in that body. We, if we're going to change that, need to elect people who grew up working class, who understand what it's like to be somebody who lives hand to mouth, who understand the struggle of having to pay your rent every month and not knowing exactly if you're going to have a house the next month because you're always living under the threat of eviction from a bad landlord. We need people who understand what it's like to live on the edges of society in the body, which decides that the edges could be round or sharp. And as somebody who had that experience and who cared very much so about the state in which I lived, and who saw a district with two Democratic state representatives who are good people, there was nothing truly to criticize about them, but they weren't out in community. They weren't building community. I started in politics in the nonprofit, volunteer, campaign, activist space, and I had been doing that since, as Phil mentioned, just about the 2015 campaign, primary campaign, when Senator Bernie Sanders got on the stage and said, universal health care isn't radical. Having a wage system that works for people who make the minimum wage is not radical. These things which would result in a world that works for all of us aren't radical. That opened my eyes to politics in a way that I hadn't seen before. I believed in politics, I believed in the history of the country, but I didn't think that somebody could speak the truth so openly, could say what we all knew inherently without having to put some political spin on it. He just got out there and said what he had believed for 30 years. And however you might feel about Bernie Sanders, that level of consistency in a politician who had been elected throughout 30 years of campaigning, that's an important thing. It was an inspiring thing. It was an inspiring thing. An 80-year-old bringing out all these different young people, working class people, people who had never voted before, to get them to believe in the system once again. To get them to believe that if we engage in the system, if we put our say into politics, if we get to know what's going on in those buildings, maybe we can make a change too. And that inspired me to get involved in politics, and from 2015 on, I was working in different issue campaigns, you just get out there and you talk to somebody. What's the next rally that I can go to? And then from there, you talk to the next person, and you talk to the next person, and you talk to the next person, and the next thing you know, you find yourself organizing rallies and building different campaigns around raising the minimum wage, building different campaigns around bringing our education system here in the state, which is completely inequitable, to a place where no matter your zip code here in the state, you can get not just an education, but a good education, a thorough education that's not going to set you up for the real world and not just give you facts and figures in a disorganized way. We knew the issues that were going on, and the people who I met through the activists' work that I did, But they brought me into a place where I felt I can go to the legislature and testify. And so that's what I did. 2018, 2019, we were up there in the legislature during the Democratic House and Democratic Senate, advocating for different pieces of legislation to pass which would have fixed those issues, which would have brought our education system to an equitable place, which would have lowered property taxes and brought us to a place where we have low property taxes that fund the state in an equitable way, where the rich towns aren't getting off while the poor towns have to pay a whole host of money. We were able to advocate for a lot of different things, and seeing those bills that you were speaking to in the legislature, and again, all you have to do is go there, sign up on the little pink sheet of paper, goes to the chairman, and the chairman, unless it's somebody who likes to give you a hard time, I'm not going to mention names, but I'm looking at Jill Hammond, and we both know who we're talking about. They will hear you, and they will be respectful. There are very few of them up there who will laugh. There's one or two chairmen who will laugh maybe behind themselves while you're talking. But the rest of the committee, they look and they listen. And I've served on two committees now. I participate in a bunch of different committees given the role that I've assumed in the legislature. And I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt, most people up there in the legislature ran for office because they care about the state. They care about their community. Most people, and I'm saying this even in Peterborough, it might be a controversial thing, most people in the legislature, even on the other side, care about their state, they care about their community. They have a different vision for their community than I do as a Democrat, but they care. And when you start from that perspective, you're able to build bridges. And when even you're a person testifying in the legislature, you go and you approach them with respect, you get that respect back. And as a high schooler going to the legislature advocating for education issues, I was smarter than them all. That's what I liked to say. I was like, oh, I know better than all of you. That's the kind of kid that I was. Then you go there and you realize, oh boy, I don't know anything. But you still testify and you go up there respectfully and you talk about the bill. They listen. I had all of them from both sides come up to me and say, wow, I've been hearing that issue for the last four terms where we've debated the issue. The issue was divisive concepts in school and whether or not teachers should be able to teach divisive concepts on history and, you know, all these different things. And I went up there to advocate against that because of the importance of teaching the history of civil rights, the history of all these different topics, which were critical to my understanding of this country and myself moving forward. I advocated for pretty much that exact same thing. How could you keep this away from children? I was pointed, but respectful. And people who didn't agree with me, weren't going to vote with me, still came up to me and said, hey, what's your name? I told them, we met each other, and next thing I know, we're having a conversation where we get to talk about what they actually feel, what I actually feel, and wouldn't you know, we were able to come up with collaborations which resulted in those people changing their votes. So when you go up there, even as a kid with an idea, and you testify with respect, and you know what you're talking about, and you go down and you do it respectfully, you don't say, ah, you're the worst, but you just advocate for your issue, then change can be made. Because at the end of the day, we're all human beings. And so recognizing that, I said to myself, you know what? I could run for the legislature. I could participate in this place. If this is the people who are here, I certainly could be here. People who weren't wearing their jackets straight, they had their tie like this. I mean, some of the people up there are quite characters. They really are. And you look at them and you say, if that person could do it, I certainly could. And I think a lot of you, a lot of people who are watching this speech, I hope they feel the same way. Because all of us can run for the legislature, despite the pay. I ran for the legislature, as I mentioned earlier, against two incumbents. People with whom I had met before, Peter Leishman, I was telling Phil in the back, when we first had our meeting at Harlow's, we sat down together, and I think maybe the fourth sentence or so in, he says, well, you know, Joan, I've been here for 24 years in the legislature. Usually I'm pretty careful, but, you know, it just slipped out of me. Peter, that's longer than I've been alive. And he said, don't ever tell me that again. so I didn't. And he's not here, so I can tell the story. But we had a respectful conversation where he saw a kid who I don't think he thought was going to win, but a passionate individual who had a lot to say about the legislature. And he was the one who was respectful enough to come to me and say, hey, let me buy you dinner. Let me hear why you're running against me. I said, thank you. I'd love to meet with you. I'd love to get together. And so we did, and we had a conversation. We met. But I still said, hey, Peter, I respect you. I respect your time in the State House, but I'm still running for office. It's 2022, and I think we need people who understand the paradigm shifts that are happening in our world up there in the legislature. In many ways, the people who have been up there for so long, the world's changing underneath their feet. It's not their fault. They still have good principles, good character. They've been the example, the people who saved our state during the Great Recession from complete bankruptcy. That was Peter Leishman and Marjorie Smith. I knew that as a historian of the legislature. And I knew, despite that, that it was time to pass the torch. And I ran for office with a vision of having a working class person go to the legislature and provide that perspective to legislators who are good in character, but don't have that perspective. All of us have blind sides. We can't see everything. And that's why it's important to have such a large body of people from all different walks of life, all different sides of the political spectrum, coming together and talking about where our state goes forward. And that's the vision that I ran on. I ran on fixing our equitable education system and getting us to a place where it's equitable and where every student gets a good education. I ran on raising the wage and making sure that we have a livable wage in this state that meets the cost of living for our people here in New Hampshire. I ran on making sure the business interests, which have so calcified themselves over every piece of the legislature, whether it be our Medicaid expansion program, opening up the door for Medicaid Advantage, which is throwing people off the rolls in a whole host of different ways, destroying the Medicaid program in the ways that it's doing it, or making sure that our environment, with the landfills that are being proposed in Dalton on the North Country Lakes that are happening up there, don't happen, because the people on all sides of the spectrum up there have told them, the business interests, you're poisoning our lake. We had to spend our own money to test it, and you're poisoning our lake, and the legislature didn't even want to hear it. We needed people up there who were going to go up against those business interests and be unafraid not to politic and say, oh, let's get to know them, and let's glad hand, and let's, no. People who were willing to go up there and be pointed and to say, hey, I respect your job as a lobbyist, and you should respect mine as a constituent, as a member of a constituency which cares about this issue, as a representative of people here in the state of New Hampshire who would rather not live their entire lives being poisoned by your trash juice. That's the conversations that need to be happening between legislators and lobbyists, and I knew they weren't happening. I knew that both leadership teams had succumbed to the money, to the lobbyists, to the free dinners, and weren't going to upset their friends, even if their friends were destroying the state in which we lived. And I knew that sometimes you do need a kid to go up there who doesn't know any better and who's willing to say things that need to be said, but might be a little bit impolitic. And so I ran on that message, and we had a vociferous but enjoyable campaign. I knocked on all the doors I could here in Peterborough and Sharon. We, despite the fact that the powers that be here in the district tried to cancel the primary debate, which had happened in every election until I decided to run for office, I had some amazing friends who ran publishing companies here in this state who were willing to buck the system and say, hey, we've got a public library, let's do one there. And so we ran a debate, which was an incredible conversation between three sides of the Democratic spectrum, three different visions for where we need to go based in the same core principles. And it was an honor to be in the middle of two people who I had disagreements with, but greatly respected, Peter Leishman and Ivy Van. And those two people, we had a good conversation, a good debate, we had a good campaign, and in the end, I won. And I won because of the respect and the grace of this community, which was able to see a young kid at their door, knocking on their door, asking them to vote for him, and saying, wow, that really is the vision in which we're looking for here today, where people here in Peterborough have been begging for it for a long time, having people up there in the legislature that are willing to speak up against those business interests and do not what's popular, but what's right for the legislature and for the state here in New Hampshire. And so it was an honor to win that election, and it was an honor to get into office. And when you're first elected, you get an email from leadership. They send you an email, congratulations. You are now a member of the Democratic caucus here in the state of New Hampshire. And you get a few orientation piece emails. Here's how you set up your website. Here's how you look into filing legislation. When you first get elected, the legislative filing period happens once every year. It's about a week and a half long process in which you have to file legislation. I knew that, and I knew as soon as you get elected in the primary that you have to start thinking about that immediately, because elected representatives do that in the second week of September, and when you're a newly elected representative, you have until the second week of November to get that done. So I only had a month to compile all the legislation which I might have proposed, and everyone else had the same time. So you're immediately, as soon as you're elected, you get about 5 seconds to celebrate, and then you're off to the races. Calling different commissioners, calling different representatives, calling chairmen and ranking members of the committee, and getting together with them to talk about different pieces of legislation which you may be willing to propose. In my first term, I proposed one piece of legislation. In the first year of my first term, I proposed one piece of legislation which would have removed the postage stamp cost for an absentee ballot, something that 11 states in this country on a bipartisan basis have already done. It's a very small expense. It would have cost around $125,000 for the state, which is, I think, 0.0001% of the state's $16 billion budget. And we had a public hearing. Every bill, once you propose a piece of legislation, gets its public hearing, as I mentioned in the beginning. And so after proposing a bill, it goes into what's colloquially known as the hopper. So you propose a piece of legislation, you have it, you go to, how you propose a piece of legislation, how you write it, is by going to the drafting staff that exists there in the legislature. They are hired throughout terms, they're state employees. You go to them, and they're lawyers, they're different drafters, people who understand the state statutes to a T. Working with them, you craft the text of the legislation, and then they spit that out of their system. Then you have your bill, and then your bill goes to the Speaker of the House, who is the elected chairman of the body. When you first get elected in December, the first week of December, we have a constitutionally mandated organization day where the House gets together, and all of us newly elected individuals, we've all at this point only met with our caucus, which means we've gotten together with the Conference of Democratic Representatives. The Republicans have gotten together with their conference. They've all met independently behind closed doors and decided who their leader is going to be for the next term. And whoever gets the majority in the legislature, their leader is the person most often to whom gets nominated for speaker. And then that person runs for speaker. And if the majority party doesn't have any dissent, then that person gets elected as speaker. And the speaker decides which legislation gets assigned to where. We have the weakest speaker in the country. In most places, a speaker can stop a bill from being introduced. They can pocket veto it and keep it from being going forward in the process. Chairmen in other states can do a similar thing. But here, the speaker, the chairman of the body, is an administrative role. All the power of the House resides in the full body. And so the House has to take action as a full body. Most of the time it's majority vote, sometimes it's three-quarters vote, so two-thirds, which is about 240 some odd people, depending on attendance at the day, have to vote to move forward a motion. So the speaker has very limited power, but he does assign your legislation to which committee it's supposed to go to. So when you propose a bill and you go to OLS, you have your bill, The speaker decides, okay, this bill has to deal with elections, so I'm going to submit this to the election law committee. And from there, you're the chairman of the election law committee once the bill is assigned in the docket process, which is all online. All of these steps have to be public. And so online at the House website, which is gencourt.gcnh.com, but if you just look up New Hampshire General Court, it's the first link that comes up on your web browser. You go into that website, you find docket. All of this information is right there as the docket, although it's not very clear. They use jargon, they use abbreviations, but after reading it for so long, it opens up, and once you understand what they're saying, it becomes a lot easier. But the speaker assigns your bill to committee, the committee takes your bill, and then the chairman each week decides which bills are going to be on this week's calendar. Every week in the legislature, the House clerk, who is elected in that same Organization Day meeting, releases the House calendar, which is all of the different committee meetings, all of the bills which are going on the floor in that week, if we are going to have a floor vote, et cetera, go on to the House calendar and then move forward from there. And that is public as well. You can go on to GCNH, look at the House calendar, and see what the House is doing each week, what committee is meeting, if they're meeting off-site, where they're meeting in the LOB, et cetera. Everything that the legislature does is done in the calendar. Your legislation goes to committee, and then once in committee, you get a public hearing where the public is noticed in the calendar that you can come to your public hearing of the bill, propose it, get it done. You go there. I spoke to my bill. I advocated for it. I gave great reasons as to why we shouldn't pay for postage here in the state, and they failed the bill by one vote, although at the time our committees were tied 10 to 10. So I had a Democrat who just was a little confused vote the wrong way, and the bill failed. And you have to, in order to reconsider a bill, it has to be a majority vote. So she immediately sees me and goes, I'm so sorry. I just said the wrong word. I said the wrong word. I said, it happens, Heidi, no worries. But then I had to get a Republican to vote for reconsideration in order to pass the bill through committee. I couldn't find one. So the bill went on the floor. After a bill gets voted on, it goes onto the House calendar, and each side of a committee vote gets to write up a little blurb. We voted yes on this bill for this reason. We voted no on this bill for that reason. And then that gets put on the House calendar, and the members get to read all 20 of the committee's different House calendar reports. You look at it before you go on the floor, you read the bill even further, and then you move forward from there. So we had the reports on the bill. I bring the bill to the House floor. The bill's, I think, the first or second on the House floor for that day, so I'm all nervous. It's my first time at the well. I didn't really know what I was going to do. So 400 legislators. I had spoken in front of people before, but the House chamber, we've been using that same building, that same chamber, those same four walls since 1816. A lot of different people have served in that body. John P. Hale, famed abolitionist. I wouldn't be standing before you today in many ways without his efforts and work for the state of New Hampshire. He also served as Speaker of the House of Representatives here in New Hampshire. We have Franklin Pierce, who I'm not as much of a fan of, but he's still up there and is an illustrious man who did have, I think, a little bit of, history marks him as a failed president, but I'm not sure exactly that should be the case. He lost his wife and everything. But this is an austere body, and you feel that when you walk into the chamber. You feel that as you go down to the well. And I'm walking down to the well between section 4 and 5 of the seats. I get there and I stand at the podium and I think to myself, okay, I'll be all right. As soon as I get to the podium, whew, okay. I gave my speech. The bill failed by 7 votes, unfortunately. But that was the first of 66 pieces of legislation which I have proposed over my 3 years in the legislature. 66 pieces of legislation, like, as Phil mentioned, banning hair-based discrimination here in the state. Now, I've faced hair-based discrimination, but this came out of different salon and hair people who came to me across the state and said, My clients, when they go to school, are getting persecuted by their teachers. When they go to work, they're being threatened of removal from their job if they don't cut their hair. This is happening throughout the state. Can you do something about this? And my immediate answer, having heard about the Crown Act before, which, don't ask me to do the acronym, but it's the legislation which has been passed throughout the country in about 12 different states, which bans hair-based discrimination through a couple of different ways. I researched that very deeply over the course of the second summer, proposed that legislation, and after a ridiculously intense committee process in the House, got that legislation passed unanimously on the House floor, unanimously in the Senate, and then signed by Governor Sununu in the summer. Legislation which dealt with how many renters can be in a building, in a bedroom together, where you had cities across our state which restricted the amount of people who can live in a home together by bedroom, unrelated people. So you could have a family of 10 living in a two-bedroom house, but if you're living unrelated with three roommates in eight towns throughout the state, big towns, Derry, Nashua, these are college towns which need the housing, you weren't allowed to live together. In the first term, I proposed legislation. We didn't get it through. It was a hard debate. In the second term, I proposed it again. Well, Diane Power proposed it again, and working alongside a host of different representatives on all sides of the aisle, we got it done. In total, out of 66, I've passed 39 of them through the House of Representatives and 19 through the State Senate to be signed into law. I'm very proud of that record as a young individual who came to the legislature and is working as hard as I can to get that done. And I, as I said, I'm a working person. I do topography surveying and driving, so if any of you need a drive somewhere, if any of you need trash cleanup, you know who to call. And you get that done alongside a mileage payment, and that's how you pay rent. That's how you get your bills done. You're not making any money, but you're serving the people of the state of New Hampshire. You're opening up the process so that all people can participate. And I'll end by saying this. When I have people, young kids, fourth graders, or when I have people who come from Rivermead who tore the state house, or when I have people that come from across the state who tell me, hey, you're that kid who ran for office and got elected at a young age. You've passed a lot of legislation, haven't you? You've gotten this done, haven't you? I say proudly, yes, I am, and you can be too. Any of us, any one of us, can run for office, no matter our position, our principles, our beliefs, put that out to the people and have change be made in the legislature. There is a lot to criticize about the place that we're in here in New Hampshire. A lot to criticize. But the values and principles which made this state great, which opened up the transparent nature of the legislature, which allowed for a state to be the first one to create a constitution which came out of the germination of citizens coming together and voting on it. Not just a constitution imposed on people. People had to come together, and it didn't happen for 15 years. 15 years of voting, deliberation, committees, talking to each other, having unorthodox conversations, and coming up with a collaborative solution. Not writing anybody off as you're a Republican, so I'm not talking to you. You're a Democrat, so I'm not talking to you. Or you're a dino, you're not sufficiently a Democrat, so I'm writing you off. You're a Republican, so you're not sufficiently a Republican, and I'm writing you off. Instead, coming together as a legislature, as people who ran for office in a grueling process and coming together to serve in the most austere body, in my opinion, in the history of this country. It's an honor to be here in this Lyceum. It's an honor to have spoken with you today here, and I hope in my talk that I demystified the legislature sufficiently enough to where one of you or someone watching feels confident enough that they too, a working class person, somebody who may have unorthodox beliefs, can go up to the legislature and win. So thank you all very much. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jonah, for your insight about the experience of being in the legislature and the process of getting things from soup to nuts through the process and into a real law. So we appreciate that. We have some time for questions from the audience. For those watching virtually, you may continue to submit your questions by using the live chat section on YouTube while the ushers collect the yellow cards from those of you here. Let me begin by asking this question. And you alluded to it, I think, a little bit. How can a person your age, who presumably needs to have a job to support himself, find the time and commitment of effort to be an effective representative when they may have a family to support or even just themselves to support?
Well, thank you, Mr. Runyon. It's a great question. Part of the answer is you have to be willing to sacrifice those 2 years that you're signing up to the legislature for. You're not going to be saving any money. You're not going to be making any money. But you can sufficiently create a schedule which works to just get by. And I, you know, just want to be fully transparent about that. That's, if you're a working class person, that is the life that you have to be willing to. You're not going to be taking any fancy trips or eating any fancy dinners. You're going to be living hand to mouth when you're a legislator. But I do have to say, my time commitment in the legislature from January to about April, the second week in April, is around 5 to 4 days a week. That is a little unorthodox. I am privileged to be a point person for a lot of my colleagues in the legislature, and so I have to be up there a lot more than the average representative does. But you can run for office and choose not to serve on a committee and participate on the floor, and then you could be there once or twice a week for 3 months, and then once or twice a month for the remainder of the session. So the time commitment varies depending on what committee you're serving on, how many bills you've proposed, and what you want to get out of the legislature. And so I tell people, you can absolutely make it work without having to be there 5 days a week. Although, hopefully one day, we're in a place where we get a little bit of a per diem where people can make it work a little bit more.
Okay, thank you. I've got a question here from the audience. What's the best way to express our concerns on proposed legislation that we'd like you and Peter Leishman to consider, to advance?
Well, you can reach me on my phone number or my email. I have my legislative email, which they just changed, so I can't say it off the top of my head, but it's available on my website. And my phone number, which is 603-831-9916, goes directly to my phone. I answer every call, answer every text message. It might take me a second, but I'm going to get to it. Peter has his email available online, his legislative email. I think it's pleishman@aol.com. But to reach out to the legislature in general, you can. There's a few different things you can do. You can email the committee members via their legislative email. I think that's the best way. If you can't make it to Concord, to email your legislators and to let them know how you're feeling about something. It doesn't even have to, you don't have to reach out to just your legislator. If a committee is dealing with an issue which you have a passion about, you can email the members of that committee and it goes to them just the same. And it is just as impactful. You know, I get emails from people all across the state telling me very impactful things, and I read every email that I get, and many of them are very impactful. And I know that, and not every representative I do responds to their emails, but I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt, every representative reads their emails. They can't help themselves. And so send them as many messages as you can. I'd say. But the best way to reach the legislature is if you have the time coming to Concord and participating in the process, getting up there, testifying, and making your voice heard in person.
Thank you. As you can see, we've got a lot of questions here. I guess one that came over on the live chat process was, have your views about an issue ever been significantly altered by a comment or a position that's been taken by somebody who's contacted you?
Significantly, no, but there have been issues of, when I got assigned to the Environment and Agriculture Committee this year, it was a bit of a surprise, to say the least, but that's a story for another time, and I didn't know much about the, it's a totally different section of the law than criminal justice, and so I didn't know much about the committee. They kind of just thrust me onto the committee, but I had to learn a lot there, and I went into it being much more of an advocate of the regulations that we had here in the state. I thought the state was totally okay. I thought we had a good agriculture commission that was doing good work. But my views have definitely been altered in hearing the stories of farmers and other people who are involved in the people who want to sell their agriculture products and how hard it has been for them to create healthy, non-GMO products that can be sold. And that has certainly changed my mind and made me more passionate about making sure that we can be in a place. I've always cared a lot about healthy food, and caring as much as I can has resulted in me caring even more after hearing the stories of farmers that were going through a tough time that I had no idea about.
Maybe this is a little bit relevant to that. As a politician, you often have to decide to protect or favor one group of citizens at the expense of perhaps another vulnerable group of citizens. How do you make that? How do you make that decision when the issue involves something like that?
Well, I've spoken about before how being in the legislature and dealing with a number of different social topics and things like that, it results in you having to respect the rights of the majority while listening to the minority, and vice versa. And that is a difficult thing to do that can't always be achieved. You're not going to make everybody happy in the legislature, and it's important that the legislation that is passed follows the anti-discrimination law, which I think is one of the best in the 50 states of this country, and an RSA, a state statute that's worth reading if you have not. It's beautifully crafted and fits very strongly to make sure that people of all protected classes in this world have protections from discrimination in the state of New Hampshire. And there's things like that. You have to make sure the legislation fits the existing state statutes that are protecting of the minority rights of people here in this state.
And I think we may have time for one more. Do you think your age has been a detriment or an advantage in dealing with others who may be significantly older, perhaps? In dealing with these issues, do they tend to credit your youth as having a new perspective on something, or do they tend to dismiss you because you don't have their experience?
It's a little bit of both. It's a little bit of both. I'm sure people always silently dismiss you when you still have baby skin and you look like a child. I'm sure people are like, okay, sure, you know what you're talking about. But, you know, that's natural. I wouldn't want people to look at kids and say, wow, that person really knows what they're talking about. We'd have a pretty wacky world if that were the case. I'm glad that there is a little bit of trepidation on the part of people who look at me and say that at first glance. He has no experience. And then I start talking, and people, I think, those preconceptions wash away. I've had that told to me by a few people. In some ways it's a hindrance, in some ways it's a benefit, and some days I don't even think about my age. It's an amalgamation of people, and we need all different people, people with experience, people who are new, up in the legislature, and I've loved just getting to meet everybody. And they don't tell me the comments about my age. They do that behind my door.
Okay, so what do you think is the next burning issue the one that is likely to affect most of us that's going to come before the legislature, and how do you feel about that?
That's an easy question. The education funding issue is going to be a big issue in this next year of the 169th General Court. The court has determined, as it already has a few times, but in this most pointed of ways, the Supreme Court of the state has determined that an adequate education state aid would be around $7,100 per student, which I had legislation in the last biennium knowing that this was going to come about, which would have raised it to $7,100 per student. We, through deliberation, got that through the House after whittling that down a little bit, found the money for it. The Senate moved to interim study my legislation, but it was a big deal that we got it through the House on a bipartisan basis. The legislature this year is much more against. We're not going to find that same same nonpartisanship on an issue. It should be nonpartisan, and I think it's going to be an interesting debate that has to happen, because there are a lot of Republican representatives who represent towns that are burdened by the existing property tax structure and the existing education structure in their towns, and them know that, but they do what's called taking a walk, which they just find themselves not in the chamber at the moment of the vote. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Okay, one more, if you would, please. I think we're all aware of the fact that many issues that had been funded and dealt with at the national level are being pushed back to the states to deal with. How do you feel about the state's willingness and ability to deal with some of those issues, Medicaid, such as that?
I am very disappointed right now in the legislature who, you know, if I had hours, I could tell you a million stories. But the budget this year was very poorly crafted. I would have disagreed with the Republican budget, I think, in any of its forms. But this year, the way the process was sickening. The legislature in its history used to hold public hearings throughout the state. The speaker would organize different places in which the finance committee could go, a hall such as this, have people come, have a microphone there, have the legislators up front, and a traveling public hearing where people across the state could have their say on the state budget. I mean, when you're talking about Medicaid funding, it's people who are immobile in a lot of ways or homebound. And these are the people who are getting that funding, and they cannot come to the legislature to tell their story. And the legislature, the Finance Committee this year, decided we're going to do one public hearing in the House chamber. We'll go as long as needed. As many people can come as they need to come, but it'll be one hearing and then we're done. And they did that one hearing. The chamber was full. The gallery was full. The hallway was full. I stayed the whole time. But the chairman of finance decided he was gaveling people down. Someone would get up and speak about education. Somebody next would get up and speak, and they'd also want to talk about education. I've already heard about education. I don't need to hear any more. And that's how the people of the state of New Hampshire were treated by their legislature this last biennium. And it resulted in a budget which added a $200 copay to the Medicaid payments to make up the difference for what's happening here to the cuts to the funds. And they said, it's just $200. Big deal. These are people on Medicaid. $200 is a huge deal for people on Medicaid. It's a huge deal for about 60% of the country that can't meet a $500 emergency payment. And I think the state right now, unless the legislature changes hands in the next biennium, is going to have a very hard time dealing with the things that are coming down from the federal government, because in many ways they agree that those programs shouldn't exist, which is despicable.
Thank you. Thank you again, Jonah.
Thank you, Phil. And
for sharing your time and your insights with us. We hope you've enjoyed today's presentation of the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. Thank you for your support of our 2025 season. Please join us next week to hear Douglas Anderson talking about something a little bit different, musicals that matter, from Showboat to Hamilton.